Chapter 4. Love is as love does. Love's dual nature. Whatever dies was not mixed equally. John Donne, The Good Morrow. Having it all. Biological and social theories of love both tug on my heartstrings. When I notice my heart beating faster at the thought of a loved one, or feel the rush of adrenaline when we are together after an absence, I'm drawn to the biological view. There's nothing socially constructed about this love that I'm experiencing. This is a natural phenomenon. If I want to understand what's happening to me, I need to understand what my brain and my body are doing. Advances in biological and psychological sciences are making it clearer and clearer that a human in love is just what every other human is. An animal with a biology and a complicated evolutionary history. These features of ours are natural. They are discoverable. If we do good enough science, we'll figure them out. Then again, when I get frustrated with the social norm of universal monogamy and hearing about how being in two relationships means I'm not really in love, it seems obvious that romantic love is what we, collectively, socially, make of it. We may have chosen to make it monogamous, but it doesn't have to be that way. There's this package of traditions and expectations that we've bundled together and labeled romantic love, and it gives our society a certain structure. But as soon as we know a little history, sociology, or cultural anthropology, we see clearly that this isn't the only way a society may organize itself. This is enough to land me squarely in the dilemma set up in my first two chapters. How can love be both biology and a social construct when biology is not a social construct? The dilemma presents us with a series of choices, arranged roughly as follows. These things aren't perfectly aligned, but broadly correlated. On the one hand, we could approach love as a natural phenomenon. We could start from the assumption that it is universal, or nearly so, in our species. We could attempt to learn more about it by studying individuals belonging to that species, deploying the methods of natural science. On the other hand, we could approach love as a social construct, starting from the assumption that it is localized to specific cultural contexts. We could try to learn more about it by studying societies, deploying the methods of the humanities and the social sciences. It's tempting to try to have it both ways. To say that love is both biology and a social construct. In fact, quite a lot of theories of love initially sound like they're trying to do just that. But disappointingly, on closer inspection, it usually turns out that either they aren't saying this at all, or they never explain how it's possible. The desire to have it both ways is fairly common, but coming through with the goods is much more challenging. One way of gesturing at the idea that romantic love is both biological and social is to say that society or culture shapes how love is expressed, while love itself is an underlying biological phenomenon. This downplays the importance of the social side of love, however, relegating it to mere expression. It is a truism that culture shapes expression. The wisdom that I'm looking to preserve, that romantic love is a social construct, is not a truism, and it's not about expression. Another such gesture is to say that culture, art and literature, for example, can be a source of clues about what love must be like. But this, again, downgrades the role of culture to signposting, something that just provides us with pointers to where the real biological action is. On the other hand, there are those who gesture towards both the social and biological but ultimately opt for a social theory of love. One version of this strategy is to say that romantic love is a social invention, albeit one prompted by biology. In this kind of approach, the biology of love gets downgraded to a mere historical precursor. The third common strategy is simply to state that love is both biology and society without doing anything to resolve the appearance of contradiction this creates. Stand back, I'm going to try metaphysics. There is still work to do. This is conceptual work. We need to re-examine our ways of thinking about love, about what is real and what isn't, what is natural and what isn't, in order to make sense of what looks like a contradictory situation. It is, in fact, just the kind of work metaphysicians do. I propose a new theory of romantic love. At its core is the idea that romantic love has a dual nature. It is ancient biological machinery embodying a modern social role. The real conceptual work, however, is to see how love's dual natures fit together. Here, it helps to think of an actor playing a role in a TV show. As you're watching the show, you might notice various things about the character, his haughty behavior, perhaps, or his complicated relationships with the other characters. At the same time, you might notice various things about the actor, his smoldering eyes, as it might be, or his almost unsettling facial symmetry. There's nothing strange about the fact that in watching the show, we notice features of the character as well as features of the actor. It would be strange, however, to ask which one we were really looking at, the character or the actor. As soon as we understand the relationship between actor and role, that seems like a silly question. Romantic love is like this. Some of our ancient, evolved biological machinery, a collection of neural pathways and chemical responses, is currently playing the starring role of romantic love in a show called Modern Society. As we watch this show play out, we might notice various things about the social role, the character, as it were, the way it structures a society into nuclear families, maybe, or its complicated relationship with gender. At the same time, we might notice various things about the biology, the actor, the involvement of dopamine, say, or the brain regions that are implicated. The crucial point is that nothing determines that one of these aspects of love's nature is what love really is, to the exclusion of the other. Of course, we could decide to use the phrase romantic love only to talk about the social role, or only to talk about the biological machinery. But the current meaning of that phrase is vague and imprecise. It doesn't force either interpretation. The full story will be one about love's dual nature. Love's biological machinery is something natural, which we discover rather than create, to be studied primarily by the natural sciences. It is something we would expect to be a human universal in the sense of being consistent across time and place, though we can still expect to see interpersonal variation, as with other aspects of our biology. It is something we can investigate by studying individuals, while also acknowledging that it's important to understand how we have evolved as a species. Love's social role, on the other hand, is at least partly an artifact, which we create in the process of setting up a societal structure, to be studied primarily by the humanities and social sciences. And it is something we would expect to be localized to specific times and places, though we should anticipate influences and similarities across time and place, as with other aspects of culture. It is something we can investigate by studying societies, while acknowledging that it's also important to gather a diverse range of individual perspectives. What does all this mean? Well, it means it is right to say that romantic love is a social construct, and it is also right to say romantic love is a biological phenomenon. Most importantly, we're not contradicting ourselves in saying so, any more than we're contradicting ourselves when we point to our TV screen and say, "There's William Shatner," then go on to say, "There's Captain Kirk." What's on the screen? William Shatner embodying the role of Captain Kirk. What is love? Ancient biological machinery embodying a modern social role. Omit either half of the description, and you just aren't seeing the full picture. Who's running this show? Appreciating that love has a dual nature is just the beginning. We immediately need to ask a few crucial follow-up questions. The most important is, which of love's features belong to its social nature, and which belong to biology? We know that the line, "Beam us up, Scotty," is part of the script for a character, Captain Kirk, but that the particular mouth we see on the screen speaking that line is the mouth of an actor, William Shatner. We understand how the interactions between the two can make for great television. We need to think about love the same way, to identify what is part of the social script what is contributed by the biological actor, and how these things interact. Among other things, this is essential for understanding what kinds of control we have over the nature of love and what love could become in the future. Let's think about the idea of control. In understanding that love has a partly social nature, we open the door to critical examination of the particular way romantic love currently structures social life. We acknowledge the possibility of real, substantive change. Feminists have critiqued the role of romantic love in, for example, creating and maintaining harmful gender norms, and queer theorists have critiqued its role in, for example, justifying homophobia. These efforts have resulted in real changes to the script, real changes to what love is and what it does at the social level. When it comes to the biology of love, however, it's much less obvious that such control is possible. Our brain chemistry evolved long before contemporary social structures and may well outlast them. By appreciating the biological aspect of love, we can get a handle on what persists through social change. This is fascinating in its own right, but it too has practical implications in terms of what we can and cannot control. Sometimes, knowing our own biology may reveal limitations on what kinds of change are feasible, at least until we can alter our biology. In other ways, the biology of love can provide motivations for change. I'll come back to this later in this audiobook. Unless we're careful, though, it will be all too easy to attribute things to biology that we actually have no evidence are biological. Humanity has a long and embarrassing history, that isn't over, of coming up with biological theories of X that have no grounding in reality or evidence but feel right because they jibe with the dominant ideology of the moment. Biological theories of race are used to justify slavery or mass incarceration. Biological theories of gender are used to justify rape or depriving women of education and property. History testifies that once we are ideologically invested in a status quo, we try very hard to prove, with biology, that it is the natural order of things. This enables a dominant ideology to reinforce itself. Prejudices and injustices appear immune to criticism or challenge if attributed to a biological or natural cause. For example, if we can convince ourselves that women are biologically different from men in ways that make them bad at mathematics and politics but good at childcare and laundry, then we can justify a social structure in which women do all the unpaid, repetitive household labor. It is the natural state of things. Any attempt to change this situation is going against nature, which will make everyone miserable and is doomed to failure because you can't change biology. If we want to do the philosophy of love well, we ignore this history at our peril. Like gender and race, romantic love is an intense focus for values, political convictions, and emotions. This creates the perfect storm when it comes to attempting to discover the biological reality of love. We've already seen some ideology-driven accounts of how love naturally is. Recall, for example, Arthur Schopenhauer's thesis that love is all about each Hans finding his Greta, and how he insisted that monogamy was much more unnatural for men than for women. To add one more recent example, clinical psychologist and couples therapist Sue Johnson claims in her book Love Sense that humans in general are naturally monogamous by biological design. In arguing for this claim, she emphasizes the role of oxytocin in attachment and bonding, comparing us to prairie voles who bond in couples, raise offspring with their mates, and also produce oxytocin that seems to play a significant role in that bonding process. However, prairie voles are not monogamous, at least not sexually. Johnson does not think this impacts her argument that humans are naturally monogamous, however. Her reasoning on this point is not clear, which suggests possible interference from an ideological desire to reinforce the current cultural norm of monogamy. The interference between insufficiently examined ideology and what we feel inclined to call natural or biological often runs very deep and makes itself invisible from the inside. This does not mean we should despair of the biology of love. It just means we must try to approach it with awareness of the risks and with a questioning philosophical mindset. Nothing artificial added. To see what I mean, let's return to Helen Fisher's biological theory of love. Fisher says romantic love emerged during our evolutionary history to drive men and women to focus their mating attention on a preferred individual. And so, the brain circuitry for male-female attachment developed to enable our ancestors to live with this mate at least long enough to rear a single child through infancy together. Right away in these passages, we see a strong association between romantic love and reproduction. Again, the theory of love on offer is not far from that found in the K-I-S-S-I-N-G rhyme. There is also an immediate association between love and hetero-coupling, conveyed in the unquestioned deployment of phrases like men and women and male-female attachment. Fisher goes on to associate the evolution of romantic love with specific reproductive gender roles. She says the arrival of bipedalism in our evolutionary ancestors caused a problem for females. They became obliged to carry their babies in their arms instead of on their backs. And then these females began to need mates to help feed and protect them, at least while they carried and nursed a child. Here, the evolutionary origins of love get tied to the idea that females have a principal role in child-rearing, and this renders them needy and dependent on males. Fisher presents the nuclear family, and hence the evolution of romantic love's brain circuitry, as evolution's solution to this female neediness. Correspondingly, the male-female attachment she identifies as the sequel to romantic love normally lasts approximately 4 years, just long enough to get a child through infancy. Fisher also strongly associates romantic love with monogamy, which in turn gets linked back to female neediness. She says that with the arrival of bipedalism, pair bonding became essential for our female ancestors. By contrast, it only became practical for males. The relevant practicalities are gestured at in asides, like, how could a male protect and provide for a harem of females? But I'm not sure what this kind of rhetorical question is supposed to establish, since in many species, humans included, this model has often been realized. In short, Fisher's whole account of the evolutionary origin of love is infused with norms around gender, reproduction, heterosexuality, and monogamy. All these norms happen to be the ones that are familiar from our own contemporary cultural setting. But what really is the biological evidence that female neediness is part of the natural order of things and the true evolutionary basis for romantic love? Fisher pictures a bipedal hominid who must carry a baby in her arms, imagines her being unable to thrive without relying on a male provider, and proceeds from there. But the naturalness of this picture may owe much to the social conditions in which we now find ourselves. After centuries of preventing women from owning property, being educated, working outside the home, and so on, it may well seem natural to think of women as needy and dependent. We are conditioned to see women as only suited to full-time childcare while a man takes care of business. We see this pattern wherever we look, whether we're doing big things like electing officials or appointing CEOs, or small things like deciding whom to hold the door open for in a corridor. And we'll see it when we're doing science. As a philosopher, I have come to think that the biology and evolution of love are important for understanding what love is. That's why I think it's important to get them right. This means we have to go by what the evidence actually shows rather than by what feels natural. Fisher's hypotheses may sound natural, but they raise a lot of questions in my mind. For example, Fisher estimates that bipedalism began among our ancestors around 3.5 million years ago, and she proposes that something recognizable as romantic love evolved between 1.8 and 1 million years ago, following the advent of language, which led to protracted childhood and hence, as she sees things, the need for a longer-term partner. But if over 1 million years passed between the arrival of bipedalism and the evolution of love, then there must have been other solutions to the problem of having one's hands full of babies that worked well enough to keep hominid evolution going for over 1 million years. What about extended infancy meant that we couldn't extend those solutions? And if bipedalism posed such a problem for female ancestors specifically, how come we didn't end up with male-only bipedalism? Why doesn't the development of universal bipedalism better support the speculation that childcare was already a cooperative enterprise? Moreover, if bipedalism was making life difficult for mothers carrying children in their arms for an extended period, would evolving a whole new fundamental biological drive have been a more efficient solution than the invention of a simple technology such as the baby sling? In fact, drawing on a variety of research in his recent book The Artificial Ape, archaeologist Timothy Taylor places the invention of the baby sling earlier than 1.8 million years ago. If he is right, then by the time Fisher says romantic love was evolving, 1.8 to 1 million years ago, the problem of bipedal mothers having to carry babies in their arms instead of on their backs could already have been solved. Even setting aside technology, evolving a whole new fundamental biological drive would be a pretty extreme solution to a problem that could be solved in simpler ways, such as through cooperative social child-rearing in nurseries. How often does evolution take a sledgehammer approach to a problem when efficient alternatives are available? The standard model comes as standard. My guess is that the true story of love's evolution will turn out to be a lot more complicated than bipedal mothers having their hands full. One possibility is that adult cooperation is beneficial to our species, and for this reason we evolved a whole suite of brain mechanisms that promote social bonding through the formation of cooperative groups that include, but are not limited to, nuclear family units. The biological machinery of romantic love can then be understood as part of a complex system of overlapping mechanisms that evolved for the promotion of social bonding and cooperation in various configurations. This would deliver a better explanation of what really happens, as it would explain the coexistence of both traditional nuclear families and various other models. It wouldn't require us to think of romantic love as a sledgehammer evolutionary response to a single problem and, what's more, one readily solvable by other means. Romantic love would instead emerge as part of a larger cooperative evolutionary strategy. By contrast, what I call a standard model approach guides Fisher's philosophical work on the nature of love. This is the idea that one way of doing things is standard and all others are deviations. For Fisher, the standard model is a hetero-nuclear family model, complete with the reproductive gender roles and monogamous norms familiar from our contemporary cultural context. I've already unpacked the reproductive gender roles a little. Let's now turn to the issue of monogamy. Let's agree that as we evolved and infancy began to occupy a longer period, solo parenting would have become very challenging. The question is, why assume that monogamous coupling of the kind most familiar to us is the default solution to that problem? Many societies have arranged childcare in other ways. Some, for example, form polygamous family units. This has typically been patriarchal polygamy, one man with many wives and not vice versa. But bear in mind that most monogamous societies have practiced patriarchal monogamy, where women are controlled by their husbands. Fisher says polygamy is a secondary strategy for human social organization, but it is controversial among anthropologists whether this is so. Some believe polygamy is the primary human strategy. There is also a case to be made that a third strategy, namely a collective social approach, could be a better solution to the challenges of child-rearing in a state of nature than either monogamous or polygamous family units. And that this collective approach may have been a primary strategy in our evolutionary past. There have also been polyandrous societies where women have multiple male partners. These are rarer, but recent research has found that they are not as rare as previously thought, and they occur worldwide. Intriguingly, polyandry does not generally give rise to a gender-flipped patriarchy. It is more common in egalitarian societies. Child-rearing is hard. It's a small step to conclude that it's best accomplished through cooperation, which we already know humans are good at. It's not obvious, however, why we should think there is a single standard model for how humans will cooperate to raise children. Even less obvious is that the standard model would just happen to be the one that is culturally dominant around here these days, as Fisher seems to think. But rejecting Fisher's standard model doesn't mean we should conclude that some other model is standard. In Sex at Dawn, Christopher Ryan and Casilda Jatar say, "The amoral agencies of evolution have created in us a species with a secret it just can't keep. Homo sapiens evolved to be shamelessly, undeniably, inescapably sexual." They go on to suggest that monogamy is a struggle because it goes against our nature. Here, we're being offered another one-size-fits-all picture of human nature, just a different one. It's almost as if Fisher were claiming that blue is the natural eye color for humans, and then Ryan and Jatar, noting that a lot of humans have green eyes, were countering that green is the natural eye color for humans. For some people, monogamy really doesn't seem to be a terrible struggle. They say it feels perfectly natural and delightful and right. In new work, psychologists Raphael Wodarski, John Manning, and Robin Dunbar have defended the idea that there are two different phenotypes when it comes to mating strategy in humans, the monogamous type and the promiscuous type. They construct a case that both men and women are split between the two types, with 57% of men preferring promiscuity compared to 43% of women. They presented this work in a 2015 paper titled "Stay or Stray: Evidence for Alternative Mating Strategy Phenotypes in Both Men and Women." But as the title suggests, the paper compares only two models of relationship preference: long-term monogamous bonding on the one hand and short-term promiscuous bonding on the other. People with a preference for lifelong non-monogamous bonds are somehow not on the radar. Nor are people with a preference for short-term serial monogamy. In fact, the authors collapse the whole idea that there is a difference between number and duration of relationships, leading them to make claims like humans actually consist of a mix of short-term, promiscuous, and long-term, monogamous, mating phenotypes, as if long-term and monogamous were synonyms. To me, as a polyamorous reader in two long-term relationships, this just sounds like a conceptual confusion. It's tempting to seek simple models that we can easily understand, but the realities of romantic love aren't simple. Oversimplifying a complex situation is not good science, and it's not good philosophy either. I have yet to see convincing evidence that a single standard model for human relationships is hardwired into our biology. Positing two types is a step in the right direction, but a very small one. As a species, modern humans are a romantically diverse bunch. What comes naturally to us varies. Our infinite variety cannot be reduced to one or two standard models. To the exclusion of all others. We've seen how a biological theory of romantic love can be deployed to connect love with specific gender roles and with monogamy. It can also be used to connect gender and monogamy with each other. For example, Fisher thinks that female neediness is the reason romantic love evolved, and thus ultimately is what caused our ancestors to become monogamous. Nowadays, we are strongly socially conditioned to see monogamy as a thing that women desperately want and men grudgingly agree to. But what evidence is there really for the claim that women want monogamy? Some contemporary research suggests the opposite, that women can struggle with monogamy at least as much as men do. Hetero women are apparently much more likely than hetero men to experience a loss of sexual desire in long-term monogamous partnerships. Psychologist Dietrich Klissmann investigated survey data from 2,500 participants and found that men and women reported equal lust for each other at the beginning of a relationship. However, as the relationship progressed, a marked decline in sexual motivation occurred in women but not in men. Other research casts into doubt the assumption that female sexuality is typically directed toward established intimacy. When psychologists Meredith Chivers and Amanda Timmers found that hetero women were often genitally aroused by erotic stories about encounters with either their long-term partners or male strangers, they also observed that erotic stories about the subject's friends, despite all the established intimacy, did not elicit comparable levels of genital arousal. The methodological question of where to look for evidence of women's supposed natural preference is important. Strong social pressure to have and express preferences for monogamy creates conditions under which it is complicated to find out what women naturally prefer. Simply asking what they want is prone to elicit the conditioned answer. We need a subtler approach, a search for clues. By measuring things like the drop-off in women's desire for long-term monogamous partners, or their arousal by erotic stories about strangers, we can gather indirect evidence that may point to a rather different pattern of natural preferences behind the social conditioning. We must also confront another problem with Fisher's standard model approach at this point. Just as we can question the assumption that romantic love is grounded in women's natural need for monogamy, we can question the assumption that romantic love is naturally geared to heterosexual reproduction. Fisher's mentions of same-sex romantic love in Why We Love are minimal and rather give the impression of being afterthoughts. Indeed, given her standard model, Fisher has to treat same-sex love as a sort of deviation from the species norm, requiring an explanation at the level of individual developmental difference. She says, for example, that gays and lesbians in all cultures also feel romantic passion. During development in the womb or during childhood, they developed a different focus for their passion. Same-sex love in Fisher's picture looks like an individual misfiring of machinery that evolved in our species for the purpose of heterosexual reproduction. But same-sex love only calls out for explanation in terms of individual deviation if hetero-reproductive coupling is built into the standard model to begin with. Given that we are strongly socially conditioned to expect romantic love to be hetero by default, we should be wary of assuming that biology made it so. We need to see the evidence. Once again, however, when we look at what we really know about biology and evolution, alternative explanations are readily available. Suppose romantic love evolved to promote intense, often sexually cemented, bonding between individuals, leading to cooperation in a range of activities, including child-rearing, among other important things. This gives us a more inclusive theory out of the box. If we didn't set out by assuming that love was originally all about male-female reproductive coupling, then we wouldn't later need to backtrack to try to accommodate queer love as some kind of deviation. The scientific method exhorts us to seek evidence for our hypotheses rather than trusting hunches. This is nowhere more important than in the science of romantic love, which is politically loaded, hugely important socially, and intimately connected with our deepest ideas about human nature, gender, child-rearing, and what makes for a good life. This is exactly the sort of area where we are terrible at having accurate hunches, but our terrible hunches keep being presented to us as objective science. The composite image. Our hunches about love don't appear out of nowhere. We've been provided with a theory of what love is since before we can remember. Think back to the K-I-S-S-I-N-G rhyme. Something as simple and apparently innocent as that rhyme packs in a lot of information about what love is and what it does. The rhyme serves to create an image of love, equivalent in essentials to Fisher's standard model, in the minds of children, and then to sustain this image as it gets passed down through generations. And a huge range of other cultural products contribute to the same end. Everything from high art, think of the two figures in Klimt's The Kiss and how much information the representation of their gendered bodies conveys. And literature, Romeo and Juliet is the ultimate classic heteroromantic tragedy. To religion, we could spend years unpacking the Adam and Eve story and its influence on romantic gender roles. and popular rom-coms, When Harry Met Sally, not When Harry Met Barry, and certainly not When Harry Met Barry and Sally. Then there are all the Valentine's Day shop window displays, the relationship advice columns, the engagement ring ads, and the endless unsolicited information on what women want and how to keep your man. It goes on and on. The character Kilgrave, in the TV series Jessica Jones, is not too far off the mark when he says, I am new to love, but I do know what it looks like. I do watch television. All these representations of romantic love add up to a composite image of what romantic love is like. I use the metaphor of a composite image to invoke the way that when thousands of individual representations are overlaid, patterns or contours will gradually emerge. Imagine building a composite image of a person by overlaying 1,000 photographs of different people who all share a similar chin shape but have different hairstyles. In the composite image, the contours of the chin will emerge as a clear feature, but the hair area becomes a fuzzy mess. We need to look for the emergent contours in the composite image of romantic love, the features that come through clearly when we overlay all those representations that pervade our culture. One of these contours is the way romantic love functions to organize a society. It serves to harness, we might even say tame, a bundle of powerful, potentially disruptive feelings and desires, channeling them into a safe, stable, nuclear family structure. Love's connections to sex, marriage, and reproduction are all related to this. And while romantic love emerges as something that allows individuals to exercise choice in selecting a partner, it's important to see how and why that choice is constrained. It is part of romantic love's role to regulate sexuality and intense bonding by encouraging its development within just one structure, the permanent, heterosexual, monogamous couple, the kind of unit that heads up a traditional nuclear family, while discouraging all other formations. Often, there are other restrictions in play as well, based on race and class, among other things. The privileged formation is the one favored with the fullest and easiest access to social and legal benefits, such as marriage, the one that we must choose to minimize the risk of potentially devastating social stigma and rejection, and the one that is most widely and openly represented and celebrated across all forms of art, culture, and social life. My point here is not just that this formation is being valued and promoted at the expense of others. It is, but more relevantly, all this representation and celebration of one particular formation are contributing to making romantic love what it is. This is the mechanism by which we collectively, as a society, create and sustain the strong contours that emerge in our composite image of romantic love. The image changes over time, and it is to a large extent under our collective control. But it shapes and defines what love is and what it does at the social level, providing us with a script that we are supposed to follow. A little biology goes a long way. Many of the features Fisher attributes to love's biology may indeed turn out to be part of the story of what love is, but more plausibly attributed to love's social script. Fisher wouldn't be the first and won't be the last to build more into a biological theory than really belongs there. There is no compelling evidence that all of our current nuclear norms for monogamous heteroreproduction have been programmed into love by biological design, but these norms are deeply ingrained elements of the social script for romantic love. They are among the strong contours that emerge in the composite image. That doesn't make them any less real. But it is nevertheless an important difference from a metaphysical and practical perspective. I am basically persuaded by a subset of Fisher's biological theory of love, the parts where I can see robust connections to the evidence. Let me recap what these are and explain why they are so important. First, I am convinced by Fisher's evidence that romantic love often involves particular brain regions and chemicals. This helps us understand the physical similarities between romantic love and other things. Oxytocin, for example, is involved in both romantic love and parental bonding. Dopamine is involved in both romantic love and the reward system more generally. Thinking of love this way can also serve to remind us that, like all aspects of human biology, the biology of love varies from person to person. Second, I agree with Fisher that the biological mechanisms involved in romantic love evolved over millions of years. We don't have to accept Fisher's specific explanations of why they evolved in order to appreciate that they did. This is important because it means the biology of love was emerging under very different conditions from those in which we now live, which is exactly why we should be wary of projecting elements of contemporary society onto biology. Knowing all this is important because knowledge is power. Uncovering the biology of love is a step in dismantling the romantic mystique, the disempowering idea that love is an incomprehensible or magical thing that we should not think too much about. Let's not forget that it took many years of serious scientific research to convince most people that there is no biologically superior race or gender. Getting a proper grip on the biology of love may help us unravel the idea that there is one biologically superior way to love. But romantic love has a social function in addition to its biological profile. To take as input the attraction and affection that arises between adults and produce as output something resembling the nucleus of a nuclear family. This is the respect in which love is like an actor playing a character. There's the social role, and then there's the biological machinery playing the role. The work of Fisher and other biological scientists is important, but it only speaks to half of this story. Now, it's not a total coincidence that certain actors get picked to play certain roles. Actors have features that make them a great casting choice for one part and a bad fit for another. Similarly, it is not a total coincidence that certain biological states in us play the social role of romantic love. But just as some casting decisions are better than others, so there can be a mismatch between love's biology and the social role it's expected to play. For one thing, society changes very rapidly compared to biology. What may once have been a good casting choice can quickly become a bad one. We need to be able to explore these questions about the interaction between biology and society without pressure to choose one or the other as love's real nature. On the contrary, we must reconcile the insights and wisdom contained in both biological and social theories of love. We must apply social critiques to biological theories and vice versa without declaring either half of the equation intellectually bankrupt. And throughout this process, we have to accommodate variety at the biological level, at the social level, and in the interactions between the two. I custom designed my theory of romantic love to create a space for all of this. We can no longer make do with half a theory, not if we have set our sights on the big picture, love in all its incredible diversity, and not if we want to understand not only what love is, but what it could be. Rebel without an answer. If I know anything about romantic love by now, it's that it's not a one-size-fits-all phenomenon. Still, I'm left with the question, does it fit me? Is the love I feel for my partners romantic? My answer is, predictably, twofold. Yes and maybe. The yes is for the biological aspect. I'm pretty confident my biology looks the way the biology of romantic love is supposed to look. Now, to be fair, I haven't scanned my brain to check exactly what's up in there. However, I can report that it really feels like the dopamine, the oxytocin, and so on are doing their thing. I've been in monogamous love before, and it felt very similar. So I'm going to go ahead and say the biology is happening. The actor is on set. As for whether it's playing the right social role to count as romantic love in my time and place, that's where I get the maybe. I'm not sure. It's not ruled out. My composite image theory of the social construction of romantic love allows that not all of the normal features have to be present in every case. Many couples count as in love who are of the same gender, have no plans to get married or have children, or in other ways don't fully conform to the script given to us by the composite image. But monogamy may still be too close to being a core norm, here and now, for my situation to be clear-cut. As one indicator of this, in On Romantic Love, Berit Brogard classifies non-monogamous relationships as an in-between case of love, along with situations where someone is just not that into you. Perhaps monogamy is still so firmly built into the script that my biological actor doesn't count as playing the romantic love role in the modern society show. But what do I care about modern society? Can't I just be a carefree rebel? Well, no. Maybe I can be a rebel, but I can't be a carefree one. In the society I inhabit, it's impossible to avoid the psychological impact of a matonormativity, the idea that if you're not in romantic love, or at least looking for it, then you're doing life wrong. While I don't agree with that on an intellectual level, the internalized attitude is hard to dislodge. The assumption is so prevalent among almost everyone I interact with that it's impossible to ignore, regardless of whether I personally agree. In the same vein, I can't just stop caring about monogamy norms because too many other people care about them. And last but not least, it's impossible for me to stop caring about whether my situation counts as a genuine case of romantic love because I know that its being recognized as such could be a powerful way of convincing people to take my relationships seriously. So I'm sad about the maybe. But while my philosophizing isn't giving me the answer I initially wanted, it's giving me much more than that. It's giving me glimpses into what the real questions are and why they matter. Philosophy once again hasn't let me take the easy way out, and I appreciate it even more than I would have appreciated getting the answer I hoped for. There is good news in the mix. Romantic love has the potential to be a far more inclusive phenomenon than normally assumed. Based on my thinking so far, I am coming to understand just how much capacity love has to change. Love's social role, at least, is quite malleable. Perhaps love's biology is too. The science is advancing to the point where such things are not unrealistic. Whatever I might find unsatisfying about love right now, I don't have to assume it will be that way forever. And that is a hopeful thought. With this hope in mind, over the next few chapters, I'll take a look at some of the ways romantic love has changed over the years and what kinds of change are still needed.